Okay,
Any questions?
so hi everybody. I thought since a lot of you folks are not disc people, I would take the approach here of trying to give an overview of what is known about debris discs in their relationship to exoplanets and some of the specific systems that I've been working on. So the very bare bones reminder, of course, debris discs are small particle populations ground down from larger parent bodies, comets and asteroids. We have one in the solar system, it's a nickel light. That's an inner warm debris disc, of which type I will hardly speak of again in this talk. Extrasolar debris discs were actually found before our own Kuiper belt, so they were the first evidence of material out beyond 30 AU or so. And I just want to make sure that you get oriented that debris discs are these optically thin, gas-poor particle discs. They are not the protoplanetary disks that happen in the very early million-year phases. These were the best evidence of extrasolar planets before 1995, so if you were a grad student circa 1990 like me and you wanted to get into extrasolar planets, this is what you did. Okay. Good thing Alex is in here. So in terms of debris disks, there have been surveys with Spitzer of a whole bunch of pointed targets. You could essentially say that all the RV planet stars have been targeted for Spitzer debris disk surveys. And then in a more general sense, stars in the solar neighborhood out to about 25 parsecs or so have been targeted, not really the M's, but all the others. And so the results of all those surveys found early on that in a very small sample, Chaz Beichman thought he saw trend where there was a tendency to have disks as measured just from their infrared excess emission, not as images. There was a tendency to have disks be more common in RV planet systems than in systems without RV planets. But that early trend has completely gone away. In one of three papers that treat this topic, Jeff Bryden reported on last year, that there just is no correlation between the detection of infrared excess and the presence of radial velocity planets. In a sample of about 300 stars, which is about 40% of them are ones with RV planets. If there's no RV planet, the frequency of disk excess emission is 14%, and if there is an RV planet, it's 9%, and these numbers are just consistent with one another. So there's no overall population trend that's available. And you might expect that if there's no trend with planets and disks, there's also going to be no trend between metallicity and disks. Those stars are all various metallicities, so you don't see the trend that you see for planet frequency. So there is this weak trend shown in this graph where Jeff is showing the strength of the disk going in this direction, how much infrared luminosity it has, and what fraction of stars. This is a cumulative plot. So here you get more and more stars.
I don't understand how that can be a cumulative probability where it's not monotonic.
I think it meant to be monotonic. It's just bad graphics.
Yeah, this is a bunch of error bars here. These are error bars. These are discrete objects being added here. So that's why you have these jumps.
The trend should always be monotonic, whereas that, what, 6 times 10 to the minus 5?
Oh, you mean right here, that little, what's happening there? That is kind of weird,
and
yeah.
Again, higher up.
Some of that is just statistical.
But nevertheless, the way you construct a cumulative probability, you rank all of them first, and then...
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a reasonable point.
It's
I should ask Jeff about
this.
It's fraction of stars. So in any case, what's happening here is that this red envelope is the planet-bearing stars and how strong their disks are as you go to a fainter and fainter disks. And these are the ones without planets. So there's a slight tendency for a planet-bearing stars when they have a disk to have a stronger excess. But again, the error bars overlap, so there's no confirmed trend.
This trend is different classes, like if you have multiple planets or more distant planets?
No, the statistics just aren't good enough. As you'll see in another chart here, we only have a very small number of systems where there
are
planets
only
and disks.
Are radial velocity planets?
These are only radial velocity planets.
This suffers from all the biases that radial velocity surveys.
Yeah, we'll get to that in the next slide here. So the reason that there is no correlation, you'd expect there to be a correlation because the debris disks, in most cases, are cold. They're detected at 70 microns. They're not detected at 24 microns. So they indicate having an inner hole that you would expect something is inside of the material. And you tell me, but if you're going to have a system that has very little material that's going to form circumstellar matter at the earliest stages, and you're going to form only a belt of debris and no planets, you're going to form that in close where the density of the disk is highest. You're not going to form it out at tens of AU. So if you're going to form small body populations out at tens of AU, you'd expect, I think, to form larger objects closer in. This is why we should see a correlation, theoretically, and we don't. don't see one for the reason you were just mentioning. RV only goes out to 5 AU, the IRXS measurements are dust at 10 AU and beyond, and only bright amounts of dust. It has to be at least 50 times the amount of dust we think is in our Kuiper belt in order to get detected. So someday when we have RV planet census going out to tens of AU, and when we have disk photometry that's getting down to lower and lower levels, these correlations that we expect to see should be there, but right now the data don't provide it.
Are you saying that Beta Pic is 10,000 times brighter than the solar zodiac?
In terms of fractional luminosity, yes.
Wow.
10,000 times. Yeah, there's actually a few that are like 3 times brighter than Beta Pic. Yeah, most of them are fainter than that, but the limit of what we can
detect. Still 1,000, like detected ones are still 1,000 times brighter than the zodiac.
There's some that are fainter than that. Now we're detecting what, it depends what you mean. If you mean in terms of luminosity.
Fractional luminosity,
there are Spitzer detections that are less than 100.
Yeah, below 10 to the minus 5?
Yeah, below 10 to the minus 5. I could point you to some papers where you have those numbers. So if you can't get a statistical correlation of the whole population of disks and planets, maybe you can talk about what's happening in individual systems. And I'm going to go through those for the rest of the talk. And so the individual system analysis that you want to do is, you know, the disk image is going to tell you what the inclination of the system is. So if you're in an RV planet situation, all you have is M sine I, that's a useful parameter. Then the dust is a field of test particles. So if you want to see what a planet is perturbing, go to a system where there's trillions of tiny little particles to respond to your perturbations and see what they're doing. And if you see structures like these that are simulated by Ozernoy for various different orders of resonances and various different eccentricities of the central objects, depending on what parameters you choose, you can get these various predicted structures for the parent bodies, where they would be located and where the dust would be located. So if you can see these structures, you can go and try to figure out what they mean in terms of the planet orbits.
And so the dust is only subject to gravity? There's no PR drag or anything?
Oh, there's radiation pressure forces that can be important, yeah.
On the bottom left one, what's the scenario that increases that one?
I'm going to have to go back to the reference and remind myself, because off the top of my head, I don't. So this is the money chart in terms of, it's kind of dense, but these are how many total systems we have now, where some Spitzer observations have shown that there's an infrared excess from a debris disk, and where there's an RV planet in the same system. All right, so there's only these 19 of them. Now, the ones at the top that I've tried to highlight here, I think are...
You're downplaying it, but that's quite impressive. You have a lot of these planets, and you have a lot of information about disks around these planets. It's much more than people had 10 years ago.
Okay, well that's true, but we're happy to have this. Yes, okay.
There's something wrong with the ordering of your table.
Something wrong with the ordering of the table. Oh, yeah, well, you're not going to like the rest of the talk, though. what I try to do is I try to highlight in boldface the one at the top, because these are ones where the locations of the planets are closest to the inferred locations of where the disk is. So in Fomalhaut, we see it. 8799, I'll talk about a little bit. We think we see it. Here, the distance is only inferred from radiative equilibrium arguments. Here, the same situation is, it's only inferred. And all the rest of these, the distance is inferred. If you want to say where the dust is, all you have is an SED. You have to make some assumption about the particle properties, and then say, for that assumption, and then consistent with the presence or absence of emission at Spitzer wavelengths, what temperature limits can you set, and then what radius limits can you set? So there are a lot of assumptions buried in here. But the bottom line is, all these lower ones, the planet, you know, is at 1 AU, the inferred disk is at 28 AU, we don't expect to see much of an interaction going on there, and all the same down to the bottom here. These are the four where they're close enough to each other that we should see some kind of interaction happening. Beta Pic is not in that list, but I'll be talking about it.
Are there multiple planet systems overrepresented in that table compared to the general?
I didn't check, but I presume not. What's the fraction of multiple planets overall?
About 25% growing.
25%? I guess there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 out of 19. Yeah, that's a little bit more, but the stats aren't enough to really show. So now we'll jump into each of these guys and talk about them. So Fomalhaut was originally imaged in the submillimeter, and then was found that this peak here was just a little bit brighter than that peak. And then especially when you went to shorter wavelengths here with Mark Wyatt's observations of this. And so he inferred way back in 2002 that this asymmetry was dynamically important. Later on, we ended up observing this star with Spitzer at one of the early release observations and getting these results showing that, yes, there is even a much more prominent asymmetry in the thermal emission from one side of the disk to the other. Now, we suggested a whole bunch of ideas about possible planet scenarios that could explain this. We didn't know which one was the right one until Paul Kallas got the famous von Mulhaut image with HST and scattered light at V-band. And of course, the ring is not centered. It's the center of the ring's over here, the star is over there. The only way to get that to happen is for it to be intrinsically eccentric ring. And it has this sharp inner edge, which is very important for the dynamics of the ring, and fades out on the outside where it's just falling into the noise. We don't actually know what the outer edge of the material is.
That's just summed over the whole angular extent of the ring.
I think it's not just one location, because then signal to noise isn't good enough. This is stretched really, really hard. This is barely seen.
Flat
on
the bottom is pretty impressive.
Yeah. Okay, so once this ring...
The inclination of the ring.
Oh, the inclination is, it's like 25 degrees, or no, a little less. I can tell you where to find that at the end of the talk. If you have any question about any resolved disk, I'll tell you where to find the answer at the end of the talk. So of course, Alice Quillen saw that inner edge and tried to make a relationship of that to a planet right inside it. And a lot of folks, from Mark Wyatt to us to Paul, had said there should be a planet sculpting this ring, but we didn't know where it would be located. And Alice was the first person to say, "This is if a planet is right here at the edge, this is what its mass should be." So she deserves some credit for making a prediction of that. And then, of course, as you know, the planet was actually seen with the orbital motion in the 2008. Common proper motion of the star, orbital motion, distance at 115 AU, inner edge of the ring at 133 AU. So I'll deviate.
Her mass estimate.
Her mass estimate is lower than the one that Eugene Chang later came up with. And I'll explain that in a second, what the reason was. Right here, which is that Eugene did some dynamical simulations to go along with the von Mulhaut detection. And the thing that he did in improving over Alice's work was that he actually tracked what dust particles were doing instead of what parent bodies were doing, because that profile I showed you was a profile of what the scattered light looked like. That is the dust particles. It's not a profile of the parent bodies. So when Eugene did that, he found out that he needed to have a mass that was closer to three Jupiter masses. And depending on what that was the upper limit. And the mass, depending on how massive the planet would be, it could be either further from the ring and produce the sculpting, or it could be closer to the ring. And these are the dust profiles in scattered light that he would predict. And they, more or less, these situations he can't distinguish and thought those were reasonable. And he also investigated the ring stability, and as long as the mass of the planet is less than this value, the ring would be stable. So I want to deviate into the photometry of this object, because I think you've heard about it, but I just wanted to express an opinion on a few slides from now as to what's going on. The main thing I want to point out here is that this is an extremely faint object. This is 24th magnitude, so we're talking about a contrast of a billion to one. For this object, it is probably one of the faintest. This is in invisible in 606, and so the reason HST was able to see that is because it's such a large distance away at 12 arc seconds from the star.
It's also about the red band magnitude
using 229b. Is that right? Well, it's a lot easier in the near infrared. This one doesn't get easier in the near infrared. So here's the color spectrum, and I think you've all seen what the optical measurements are and Paul's non-detection of the object here at H-band. I wanted to call your attention to the fact that we did look at this with Spitzer, with IRAC, doing an experiment kind of like what the transit searches do, where we took subarray data and got 100,000 exposures trying to not saturate the star and co-added them, got them at different roll angles and processed them and so forth. And these are we did not detect von Mulhaut B. This is reported in Marengo et al. 2009. And for the model that Paul presented in our 2008 paper, we think we should have detected it at 4.5 microns. And that goes along with the even greater model problem of not detecting it at H band.
What sigma upper limit?
This is a 3 sigma. Yeah. And so it's not detected at all these other wavelengths where the sensitivity of Spitzer is worse. And actually, the ground ended up doing better than us.
I will interject that I think that we also Our model also has some similar discrepancies. I think all the models that have been applied to this have trouble.
Well, the biggest trouble is out here, where the R-band emission that's detected is massively above what the prediction of the models would be. So the thermal emission model for this source has got a lot of issues. And the issues were the models put through I-band, expecting that a source that's 400K at this age would have the I-band flux. So the good thing about the thermal emission model is that it's consistent with these limits. The bad thing about it, as I just said, is it misses this, and it misses this. And so if you're going to take a thermal emission model, you folks have to go figure out how to replace the H-band flux with something much, much fainter. And you need to have an extra source of R-band flux. And that suggestion was H-alpha emission, but I'm not very much in favor of that. I mean, that is something that you would see in a young star that's accreting material from a disk. But you just need a gigantic amount of H-alpha emission to fill in the R-band flux and bring it up to the observed level. So there's a bunch of band-aids that you have to apply to this object if you want thermal emission to work.
If you include the light hitting the planet from that distance, it's
almost completely irrelevant. Yeah, I'm just about to get to that here. So the other model is just shown here. So the thing I kind of insisted on in the Callis group was that this is a spectrally neutral reflector going through the I-band point. You can see that's consistent, really, with all the observations, the detections and the upper limits. And so the problem, as Adam was just alluding to, is that the reflected light model for this source is consistent with all these things, but it's you would need something that's 6 magnitudes brighter than our Jupiter would be at that distance in order to produce that much reflected light. So you need to take the area of Jupiter and increase it substantially to 10 or 20 Jupiter radii. So that's not a planet anymore. That's a planet with a big cloud of something around it. So it's not crazy in the sense that at the early age of our solar system, presumably there were disks around the major giant planets forming their satellites, and they would. This size goes out to the size of the Galilean satellites in Jupiter. So something like that is reasonable at an early stage. But Fomalhaut's supposed to be 200 million years old, and you would not expect the proto-satellite disk that's gaseous, that's viscously evolving, and so forth, to still be around at 200 million years. So you would need some kind of particle disk, not unlike the main belt of Fomalhaut itself. I would maybe call it a huge planetary ring system. So if you took a 30-kilometer KBO of some kind and just smashed it up, you would produce enough dust reflecting area to produce the observations. So you would then, of course, that would evolve, and potentially that dust would go away, although it wouldn't be blown out of the system like it would be if it was away from the planet. The planet's gravity can help keep small particles around the planet that would otherwise be lost in general to the Fomalhaut system. Or maybe you can think of something interesting where you can accrete material onto the ring system, material that's on the major ring of Fomalhaut that's escaping, and then happens to pass close to the planet, collides with a pre-existing disk, for example, and then gets captured into the system. So no one's really worked on that. It's a little bit of a half-brained idea. I'm interested to see what if this can be developed at all, because, for example, all the models that migrate Neptune out, I haven't seen people keep track of what happened to the major satellite system of Neptune as it interacts with all these KBOs on the way out. Neptune does not have a regular satellite system, so does that signal that it couldn't maintain one if it was as big as Jupiter? Would it be able to maintain one? So I think this particle disk explanation needs further work.
I see the dynamicists want to chime in on that one. Yeah. The periods of the orbits of fairly bound satellites would be significantly different from many of the forcing periods during Neptune's migration. I just don't know.
No, I mean, that satellite system really disrupted with Triton's capture. Mm-hmm. What was there before, we have no idea. Mm-hmm.
But if you did have something there, is it likely that that system would be disrupted as Neptune moved out?
I don't know.
It should depend on where the
Neptune moving out by scattering kind of decimals, so it's not coming through the system, so I don't know what that means.
Well, the delta radius is getting bigger and bigger as you're going further out, so in that sense, you should. Yeah, it should go the other way.
But, all the giant planets in our solar system have the regular satellite systems as well.
Yeah.
And at least the NEAS model guys claim you can make them by some sort of scattering and capture issue. I'm not sure how unbelievable that is.
So you're saying if you can scatter and capture, you can also
eject. Well, the irregular satellite distributions do show strong evidence for collisional evolution. Is that, I think yeah. that's right. So having two things smash the size is maybe an issue, but I'm not sure that any of the irregular satellites are quite that big.
Yeah, so I guess the question really is there one collision that we're reviewing at a special time that would do this, or can you think of a model where there'd be sort of a steady state disk that is present for a long period?
Would this just be an outgassing comet?
Oh, instead of being an actual planet there? Well, I guess you wouldn't expect it to be outgassing at that distance
That's where comets are. Yeah,
from Fomalhaut. It wouldn't be outgassing there. If it was a very recent collision, it have to be very recent, because you could smash two things together and then make a particle cloud which would just expand and orbit the star the way a planet would, but it shouldn't be confined to the size of a PSF for very long. And this thing is not extended. So I don't think it's an expanding debris cloud. But I'm postulating, what about a debris cloud that's bound to a planet?
It might be interesting to look at if you really load up and again a satellite system and have a collision in what evolved, how long would it come out of here?
Yeah, but this is the kind of thing I think nobody's worked on, so I'm trying to put that into your heads.
How? What's the uncertainty on the age?
Well, the actual age is quoted by, the Spanish author, is like 100 to 300 million years. So we're saying 200 for short, but I think there's
an early type star.
People are not thinking that it's a few million, not as young as 8799. So unfortunately, data on Fomalhaut B is going to be scarce for some time, okay? And the real problem is that the ground has done as best that it can in trying to detect this object, and it hasn't happened, I mean, unless we're going to get weeks of, you know, time at Gemini or something, which I would doubt. And the HST servicing mission that just took place didn't advance the cause, because the advanced camera coronagraph, which is used to take the discovery images, was not repaired. And so we cannot repeat those observations in the visible and see this object again, I don't think. Paul is going to try with the STIS coronagraph, which has poorer contrast performance than ACS did. So it's worth trying, but I'm not optimistic that this will produce it certainly won't produce any color information. This is an unfiltered observation. So the best we could do for that is tracking the orbit.
So did you say that GPI will not see this?
This is massively outside the control radius of the deformable mirror AO system for GPI.
It's too far.
It's too far.
The outer working angle.
Yeah. Yeah, the outer working angle. Yeah, the outer working angle is like 1 arcsecond for GPI at H band. And this is 12 arcseconds.
So you get results from GPI for that.
There's another reason why your system is better.
So Paul did try J-band observations in Wide Field Camera 3, one of the new instruments, did detect the dust ring, but did not detect the object, but not at useful depths that would constrain the SED. And NICMOS was originally our intention to use that, but it stopped working, and we're not sure if it's ever going to come back again. So I think it may be the case that we have to wait until JWST shows up in 2014 to actually detect this guy and see if the flux at these longer wavelengths is consistent with reflected light or with somebody's planet emission model.
Are there any guaranteed time observing projects on GWST associated with such studies?
Well, I believe that the NIRCam team was just putting in their list of things in the past few weeks. So I have not seen the list. I know people who have, and I would be surprised if it wasn't on the list.
I would certainly encourage people to lobby the appropriate people to include something like this on that list. It's going to be a lot of competition.
I think it's going to get in the guaranteed time list. Travis?
Your preferred reflected light model drops off pretty quickly as you go along the wavelength.
Yeah.
Will it be detectable with JWST if that model is correct?
Oh yeah, I think so. It's once you get in space, you're reduce the near IR background by so much that even NICMOS we think should have detected it as a reflected light object if it hadn't failed. So
but your Spitzer upper limits are quite far above the SED reflected
light. Right. Yeah. Well, the Spitzer, the problem is the telescope is so small and the wavelengths are so long that we're working in really close to the PSF, and so that limits everything. So the shorter wavelengths and bigger telescope make NICMOS a big advantage. I don't have time to talk about this very much, but the Spitzer data also suggests definitely one additional inner dust belt For Fomalhaut at 7 AU, and another one at possibly 50 AU. So I'm hoping I can fiddle with that while I'm here. So 8799, Travis has told you everything about it. I'm going to talk about the disk, though. And so this is a paper that was published last year with Kate Sue as the first author. I'm on the author group, but there's also two other folks that were jumping in and writing papers on the disk around this object as well. This is the infrared excess around the star with the photosphere subtracted off. And the data is shown here with lots of error bars because at short wavelengths the photosphere is bright. And the spectrum comes up here and then stops. And then there's MIPS SED data and photometry data points here, here, and here. And this just fits immediately by eye almost to two blackbody components, one at 150K, one at 45K. If you just said that these are particles that are emitting like blackbodies, they would be at these distances from the star. And so that's great because the planets are in between. So jumping at that immediately, you say we've got two debris belts with a bunch of planets in between. But there's more to the story than that. The disk is spatially resolved at 70 microns. So this is the star. The photosphere is contributing almost nothing. All of this is excess emission. And in here, there are two components. There is an unresolved core in the center. Our resolution is not good here. 70 microns at 700 AU per beam. All right. But nevertheless, here's the beam size, very faintly indicated. And there's outer halo that extends out to almost 1,000 AU radius. So there is a core and an extended halo. And the first order of business here is to say that this looks roughly symmetric. So that suggests that the disk is viewed face on, you know, to within 25 degrees or so. That's a conservative limit. I think you could fit this with something a lot closer to face on and still be quite happy, but that's in total agreement with other inferences about the orientation of the system. Then, because that's resolved, you have to, and because our beam though is so big, the way you study the resolved structure is to do these radial profile analysis, collapse everything down to one dimension. The data points are up here, and then what the PSF is doing, this is at 24 microns, is shown here. So lots of what's happening here is the PSF, but then finally out here, we're starting to see a deviation between the just a point source, and the wings show that there's extended 24 micron emission, and the same thing here is now for 70, that this is a log scale going horizontally. There's still plenty of extended excess at 70 microns too. So the good thing about this is that you are getting sort of a ratio of the 24 micron brightness to the 70 micron brightness as a function of position. That tells you the temperature, and you know the distance you're measuring it from, so you can infer what the grain size needs to be if you know the distance that it's at and what the temperature it is that it has. Yes?
This is a model of PSF.
Well, there's actually two things here. So there's a model PSF here in red, and then there's an observed other star shown here in blue.
Is the data dropping below that model PSF? Is that significant?
Well, the error bars are getting giant out here. It's just sort of disappearing, so I think that's not significant there. You know, on the bottom here, the PSF model is not working as well as at 24. So Kate talks in her paper quite a bit about what the procedure is for getting to the best model for this, and so I'm not going to tell you all the sausage making that was involved with it. But the constraint is that the inner belt needs to be between sort of 6 and 15 AU with these particle sizes. And then the second component is the planetesimal belt, which has the large objects in it that produces the submillimeter emission. That's starting at 90 and going out to perhaps 300. These infrared excess measurements are really good at telling you what the warmest part of the dust distribution is, because you can see the edge rising up on the Wien side of the curve. But on the Rayleigh-Jean side, they're not good at telling you where the coldest material is. So we aren't really sure where this outer edge of this is. It can't be beyond this, or it would be more extended in the core. But that's inference for where the planetesimal belt is, with the large grains for submillimeter emission. And then there's this extended halo going from sort of 300 to 1,000 AU with small grains. And the halo has like half the infrared excess of the system. And so this is dark and hard to see, but this is George Ricci's cartoon of the three planets and the inner belt here and the outer belt. And I don't think we know that it's exactly that close. There's still, I would say there's plus or minus 10 AU on the inner edge distance. But more on the halo, when Kate did the model fitting of this, we found it was, you know, if you took a radial profile consistent with continuous outflow, minus r to the minus 1, that goes and fits the shape of the halo perfectly well. So it's what we see is consistent with outflowing particles. Now, in 2005, we saw this very bright extended halo around Vega, and argued in the case of that object, this was also an outflow of very small particles pushed by radiation pressure output from a major recent collision. We now think, some of our colleagues have told us that it's also true that weakly bound grains may be important to this too, especially because if the whole halo is outflowing, it implies a very large mass loss rate. So if some of the halo is outflowing and some of it is weakly bound things that are still grinding down to outflow sizes, that's a happier situation. One of the things that was pointed out here, though, is that the total amount of material in the halo is quite a bit larger than some nominal collisional equilibrium model. You always expect collisions to be happening in a debris disk, grinding down the grains to smaller sizes. When they get small enough, they hit a size where the star can blow them out by radiation pressure. And so in that equilibrium process, you can estimate what the fraction should be of material in the main parent disk doing this collisional cascade and the fraction that's blowing out. So that's what Mark Wyatt does, and usually it's a percent of the total dust is blowing out. Well, here we've got a lot more than that. So a suggestion that we make is that dynamical stirring by the giant planets could be exciting a lot more collisions in the belt than the belt would normally have on its own if it was in isolation. So jumping out of 8799. Yes?
In that last model suggestion, is there a limit on the mass of the planets that you would need to dynamic? If the three planets were the only ones there, does that say they have to be greater than X Jupiter masses to dynamically stir it?
To dynamically stir it? No, we didn't quantitatively assess that. We just said this is bigger than the nominal steady state rate. And we didn't try to make that inference.
Sorry, Carlos. Yeah. It's the middle pair. Big stuff, they collide with each other.
Yes.
And then they produce
this
small
dust. It makes the halo, yes. That's the idea.
You have a gap because there's a planet. I'll see the halo probably distributed uniformly, more or less evenly. The halo particle is so far away because they're planet.
Well, they're not moving in because radiation pressure pushes them out. And the halo doesn't come from the inner belt. The inner belt is there, but it's a much smaller fraction of the total system. The outer belt has much more material, and so
is the origin of the halo material.
It's the outer planetesimal belt between like 90 and 30 and 300 AU outside all three planets, which then is doing its own grinding and then blowing out.
So do you have any constraint on the possibility that this inner belt is not really a belt, but it's actually quite puffed up?
No vertical constraint at all. But we're
so
just
it could be actually quite more spherical than.
Yeah, when you have these SEDs, you just don't know what the vertical thickness of anything is, and so. Only thing you can make is arguments that it's more dynamically stable if it's flatter. If it's puffed up, it's going to have lots of crossing orbits and collisions and won't last as long. But
if you're inviting a planetesimal belt on an unprecedented scale,
well, 100 AU is kind of where the planetesimal belt is for beta pick, so that's not unprecedented. If it extends out to 300 AU, that is bigger than we've been able to infer in other objects. So the outer radius, if it's right, is on the big side, yeah. This is a system where, unfortunately, we have no resolved images of it whatsoever. So I can only give you a very quick description that it's a nearby K star, close by. It's old, and it's got an unusual population of very small dust particles. The spectrum shows all these forsterite grains and so forth. And this was found after the infrared excess to have these three planets shown here. By RV, and analysis of the dust composition can tell you what the grain size is, because you can fit the shape of the spectral features. And then once you know that grain size, you know how they will respond in thermal equilibrium, and that analysis finds that the dust belt is at 1 AU in this system, exterior to all three planets. This is a warm dust belt. There is no cold belt to go along with it at 70 microns. And stability analysis that Mark Wyatt did as part of this paper shows that the dust belt is out here. Blue is regions that are more stable. Red are the ones that are not stable. And so the dust belt was near a resonance of one of the planets and was in a region that was broadly allowing stability. This 1AU number has still got wiggle room on it. Yeah, I wouldn't call it for sure that it's in resonance. But this is a system where we, again, see if there's an exterior dust belt to planets.
Every table had something at 0.4 AU, and then their table.
Yeah, I think the table's got the wrong number. This is the right number.
Okay.
So yeah, I piped that in originally, found out that this was the right number, and didn't fix the table. Wow, you're paying attention.
Yeah, I was surprised that in between the two. That's why I remembered it.
Okay, another object nearby that's got resolved debris disk structure and planet is Epsilon Eridani. This is the closest debris disk to the Sun and the closest RV planet. For a long time, this has been known to have this ring of particles in the submillimeter that is about 60 to 80 AU in diameter, with a star in the center, in the hole in the ring. The problem with this is that it's been very clumpy and low signal to noise. Some of the suggestions were, if you go back to that chart I showed with clumps being caused by resonances of planets, people were trying to say, how can I place a planet here so that I'll produce resonant accumulations of material there or there? So there's a lot of work going on that. But as these observations were repeated, it was found that you just didn't get the clumps to come back in the same place with subsequent observations. And this is our observation made with a CSO that shows the brightest peak over here. These other wavelengths, it's here and here. This is just thermal emission on the Rayleigh jeans tail from grains. There's no reason to expect that they should be showing different peaks in different locations. So this is just low signal to noise. There is a ring here, but the clumps in the ring are just not reproducible. So we don't believe that they're really there. So don't look too hard for a planet amongst them.
The reason I ask is I remember way back when, before, in the old building at UCLA, Mike Jura used to have on his door a gallery of pictures of resolved IR images of outflowing sources in the helium cores. Mm-hmm. And they looked just like that, because they were clumps and they were edge brightened, but they were in truth.
So you, knowing Mike, he's thinking about stars that are having an ISM interaction, where dust from the ISM is getting into interaction with the star.
Yeah, so I was interpreting the rings as some sort of boundary layer. Projection of boundary layer. Could this be something similar here?
I guess I would tend to think no, because the grains are so big, inferred to be so big here. I mean, these are grains that are up to 500 microns in size and bigger. I don't think those are going to jump around too much with magnetic interactions at the edge of the heliopause.
The status of this object is the radial velocities.
We'll get to that.
That was controversial from the beginning, and I didn't know the controversy went away.
Okay, well, it's Spitzer makes it more controversial. Okay, so this is the images of Epsilon Eridani that we published last year in Dana Backman's paper. This is the ring, now rendered without its clumps. The 70 micron emission all comes from inside the ring. Not on the ring itself, so this is a different population of particles emitting here, warm, smaller particles. The ring has colder, larger particles, and it's seen at 160 microns here. And again, our beam size is, terrible. this is an 18 arc second beam size to study something that is, 40 arc seconds across. So with Spitzer, you really have to suffer a bit. We did a whole bunch of analysis, like I showed you for 8799, looking at the profiles of the emission and trying to fit models to them. And I probably shouldn't go into all the details, but they definitely need an inner belt to explain the 24 micron excess that is not extended. And you need an outer belt to explain the submillimeter ring with large particles. And you need a third population to explain the 70 micron stuff that's in between the two others I mentioned. And Dana talked himself into a still additional belt in this location at 20 AU from the star. And this is the infrared excess spectrum that's shown. The ones I think we can be most confident of are the short wavelength one here, the warm belt, and then the very cold ring out here with the submillimeter particles emitting here. And this large peak in between may be one or two separate regions. I'm not really sure. We added this component by reducing the data over again. I'm not so sure I would add it today. So the picture that emerged from that is here's the region where the submillimeter emission comes from. The 70 micron extends a little bit far beyond that, so there's a slight halo in this source too. That in next to the star, there's a belt that we can infer to be located at 2 to 3 AU. And this other intermediate belt, which may or may not be there at 20. But the problem here is that the belt at 2 or 3 AU is damn close to where the RV planet is supposed to be. It's supposed to be at 3.4 AU semi-major axis. And depending on whose data you consult, the early data in Benedict's 2006 paper, which included the astrometry from HST, said the eccentricity of this planet is 0.7. Well, that's not consistent with the particles population that's there. I don't see how you can cruise the planet through the dust belt and not get rid of it. Fortunately for the existence of the planet, this eccentricity value for it seems to be going away. This is a very noisy star. It's very active, so the RV has a very high noise in it compared to other stars. The eccentricity is now inferred on Jeff Marcy's page to be 0.3 plus or minus 0.23, which is very different from that value. And so that's much more happily consistent with the Spitzer results. And I should have put it in here, but there was a group that after we published this at the end of last year published a paper doing a stability analysis for our dust zone in the presence, just interior to the RV planet, and found out that it was possible to make it work as long as eccentricity was low. So I forgot to put that on the slide. Okay, so because we thought there would be companions at a large distance from the object, from the structure of the submillimeter ring, we looked hard with IRAC, just like we looked for Fomalhaut B. We looked for a planet, not the one at 3 AU that I was just talking about, but the purported one out at tens of AU. We looked for that with deep IRAC imaging. Didn't see it. Three Jupiter mass object at the inner edge of the ring. Further out, the outer edge of the ring, it'd be down to a one Jupiter mass object using the evolutionary models. And so there's no real evidence for the planet, an outer planet, in the data here, and there isn't any in the submillimeter ring structure, really, I don't think you can believe. So there's one probable planet in EPS area that probably has a circular orbit, or close to circular orbit. Okay, the last of the sources I want to talk about, the disk and planet interaction, is Beta Pic. This is from Golomowski's 2006 paper, the HST coronography. Remember, this is the classic edge-on disk, and there's this slightly inclined inner disk relative to the plane of the outer disk. It's very reproducible, lots of data sets, other different instruments and so forth, so it's definitely real. The interesting thing, so if you want to be able to make this inclined, presumably you need some kind of perturber, just as the situation where Fomalhaut, you need a secular interaction to make the ring eccentric and conform to the planet. You might have some sort of secular interaction here where the planet close to the star brings the ring particles into its orbital plane. And as you know, a planet has been claimed to be detected in half an arc second from Beta Pictoris. So that would all seem to hang together, although the inclined inner ring extends out considerably farther than this. So this planet is not confirmed. This planet was seen in 2003, but published in 2009. There's no common proper motion measurement. There's no photometry at any other wavelength than L-band. Folks in 2009 have tried to see it several times and not seen it. They've been arguing that, well, maybe it's orbited behind the star and we have to wait for it to come back out again in order to see it. If it's real, it's that it was seen at a projected separation of 8 AU and it would have 8 Jupiter masses for somebody's models with this flux. It's a very young system, 12 million years, so you could get a very luminous object. I just, when I was getting ready for this talk, I looked up the proper motion for Beta Pic, and it goes that way. Okay? So if this is a background object, then Beta Pic has moved right in front of it almost during the time between 2003 and now. That still could be a planet, but that's very disconcerting if you want it to be a planet. But the other part that worries me, if you want it to be a planet, is the disk-planet interaction. And the papers about this object have not spoken about this at all. They seem to not notice the Spitzer results on Beta Pic.
If your hypothesis is true, could you not go? How right would that thing be if you went back 50 years? Would you be able to see it like a Palomar sky survey?
Well, that's a good question. Now, Beta Pic is moving like at 0.1 arc second a year or something like that. So it's in the disk plane. It's a fourth magnitude star. So if you go back 50 years, it's 5 arcseconds away. That's probably still pretty hard for most sky surveys that weren't trying to do something with a high contrast imager. But you wonder if you went back to, you know, 19, well, optical images presumably wouldn't show it. So you need near-infrared images, and there weren't good ones until about, you know, 20 years ago or a little sooner than that. So the other problem with this, besides the fact it might be just a common proper background object, is the problem that there's infrared excess that we published in a 2007 paper, just the infrared spectrum, and it sort of has two components. It has this component that has long been known from IRAS, where it drops down, and the authors of the Betapic Planet paper said that the disk is largely cleared within 50 AU of the star. Well, largely, but not totally, because this is the IRS spectrum here, and it's got emission, excess emission, going all the way down here to 5 microns wavelength. And so when we modeled this in Christine's paper, the size of this feature, silicate feature, tells you what the grain particles are need to be to make that. They're 1 micron. And so we modeled it as a continuous disk from 0.2 to 2000 AU that had two broken power laws matching to a peak at 100 AU distance. And so we didn't put a model that has no gap in the central region at all is what you need to fit this data. Now, we weren't trying to make room for a planet, but the planet folks on this source didn't go and try to say that they could steer the dust away from their planet either. So I think there's an unresolved issue about how you could maintain a dust cloud at these short wavelengths emitting from, you know, inside of 10 AU or so, and it still spans the planet's orbit. Doesn't mean someone couldn't come up with a really complicated model and do it, but someone's got to prove that they can go.
Betapic is only 8 million years old. How stable do you need to be, really? I guess 82 masses is a lot, but
that's a lot.
Like, looked at dust that will get cleared out dynamically, but with 8 million years,
well,
perhaps not that old.
Yeah, the clearing process is unknown here. These particles producing this emission should be all blown out of the system, and they're not. And there's a similar problem that there's lots of sodium in the system, which through resonance scattering should be feeling strong radiation pressure forces and be blown out too, and it's not. And we think maybe there's gas in the system that puts the brakes on the blowout processes that would happen for more mature debris disks. So we're not quite sure about some of the important dynamics to assess that.
Also, so comments, inferring comments can explain this again?
If you had lots of transitory things happen, I suppose, you know. But that's what we need, is some kind of model that's going to allow this dust to coexist with the planet if it's there. So that just wasn't addressed in the original paper. So I'm going to sort of wind up here with just a quick mention of these are all the debris disks that are resolved right now. Okay, so most of these don't have RV planets. Resolved at scattered light or in submillimeter or with Spitzer. And so we need to grow this list if we're going to understand disk-planet interactions to greater levels of detail in the future. And so that's a list on the screen. You can see most of the things have been detected with scattered light space, that's HST, and then some with submillimeter over here. Just as parenthetical advertisement, if you like images of resolved disks, any disk image, your go-to site is called circumstellardisks.org, which my postdoc and I built up. So we try to keep an updated list of not just the debris disks I've been talking about here, but all the young stellar object disks too, which are actually a much, much more substantial number. For the 20 I just showed you, there's like another 90 young stellar object disks resolved at one wavelength or another. More than that. Here's the number. It tells you at the beginning. You don't have to remember. 111 pre-main sequence disks and 20 debris disks. These are only the published ones. So if you know about an unpublished one, it's not on this list. We're just waiting for the authors to finish their paper. But keep coming back to that. Give us suggestions on how it could be improved. I've got to spend a day updating it while I'm here through this month. So how are we going to get to more disk images? Well, Herschel, you presumably know about. It's working fine. I'm on one of the key projects here, and we have been getting some results. So these are new Herschel debris disk images at long wavelengths, 100 microns, 160 microns. These are just obtained in the past few months as part of our key project called DUNES, which stands for Dust Around Nearby Stars. And so this is an object at 100 microns where Spitzer just saw one single point. And Spitzer, as an 85 centimeter telescope, we have 3 to 4 times the spatial resolution with Herschel that we had with Spitzer. So we should expect in the far infrared to resolve a bunch more disks. So what was a point source to Spitzer at 70 microns is now resolved into a double lobe structure at 100 microns, which, and all of these, when we see them, I mean, the data is early, it's not cleaned up as well as it's going to be and so forth, but we're going to want to look at all of these for asymmetric structures that suggest some kind of interaction with the planetary system. This is 160 microns, and there's lots of background things going on. So this is, you know, a famous RV planet source, 51 PEG. That's all there is to it, I'm afraid. And the observations show that the observed flux here is very consistent with what you'd expect from the photosphere. So this guy just doesn't have any infrared excess. This is just a bare star. Yeah. Okay. This is our paper for the special issue on Herschel's early science results on this star called Q1 Airy, which is very nicely extended and resolved at all three PAX wavelengths. And so we have some modeling of that that's going on right now in a paper that has to be finished by the end of next week that I better read the draft of. And of course, ALMA is going to do some more things. Herschel, I don't think it's going to see a whole bunch of new additional disks that Spitzer didn't see. But I think it is going to resolve a whole bunch of them that we didn't resolve before. ALMA is really going to resolve them, but it's going to have tremendous resolution. You'll be able to get down to, like, this is a simulation of a 0.4 arcsecond synthesized beam and a source at 15 parsecs. This is the model, and after they run it through the data processor for ALMA simulator, it come up with something that looks like that. So that'll be fantastic when ALMA's doing that. But the problem is you just starve for flux at these long wavelengths, 850 microns with ALMA, and so the number of systems that you can map at this resolution is going to be small. It's going to be, you know, a dozen or.
What's the resolution in physical
scale? Well, if this is at 15 parsecs, that would be, six AU resolution or something like that. It's a lot better than 700 AU that Spitzer was having. And you might ask, what's JWST going to do for debris disk imaging? And the answer is we're not really sure yet. There's two regimes. There's reflected light, which is the kind of thing that Hubble's been doing, and then there's emitted light like Spitzer's been doing. So this is a reflected light model, and as you probably know, JWST has all these segments to the primary mirror. Okay, so how well you can do a high contrast image, you have to take an image of the star, you have to take an image of a reference star and subtract it to see the high contrast object next to it. So if the telescope is very stable, that works well. If the telescope is not stable, because the panels sort of shift position a little bit, then it makes the subtraction work badly. And so depending on how much stability you have in the wavefront for JWST, and this is all totally theoretical right now because it hasn't been launched and we don't know, the Defense Department won't tell how well they can synchronize the segments on their orbiting telescope. So depending on how stable the wavefront is, we might be able to see things like this, or it could be a complete mess. So we're sort of waiting to see. JWST was not designed to be a high contrast telescope. So reflected light, JWST is not going to get beyond the domain we've already probed with HST and with the ground, although for some bright disks, it'll be able to take the first images of them at like 3 to 5 microns, and that will be useful because you could take an image in the water ice line, for example, and see if the disk shows spectral characteristics that are interesting. Then the emission region, it'll resolve a couple dozen disks there too, and those Fomalhaut's image from JWST will be great.
JWST, you won't be able to do the roll subtraction like you do with HST.
I think you can still do it to some limit, but not even as much as, I mean, Spitzer, you have to wait for the source to rotate on the sky. So things on the ecliptic, you can't really rotate at all. And things that are near the ecliptic pole, if you observe them at 2 epochs 3 months apart, you can get a 90 degree rotation. So that kind of thing will happen, but then that's deadly for wavefront stability to come back 3 months later, because who knows what happened to the telescope segments in the meantime. So I just wanted to close by saying I'm at JPL, so one of my jobs is to think about new missions that would be interesting. And since I work on disks, I think about what new missions would be good for disks. This is back to Jeff Bryden's plot with a step function I'm going to ask him about. And essentially, all the disks to the right, there's never been a disk detected in scattered light whose fractional luminosity is less than about 10 to the minus 4. All the ones that are detected are over here. Okay, so only 2% of all stars have a disk that bright. and not even all of them are detected in scattered light, because in some cases the disk is too small and close in. So there's a huge amount of known debris disks that we can't image right now because our high contrast system isn't up to the task, either because it can't look close enough to the star or because it can't get enough contrast. So if you could improve the contrast by a factor of 10, you could get, you know, down here to increase by a factor of 10, or factor of 5 increase in the number of resolved disks, and study what's going on in outer solar systems. So what are the next steps in coronagraphy that can do that? Well, we've been trying for 10 years now with various proposals to make a small mission to discovery, and then NASA mission concept studies, and in our very wet behind the ears days, we even submitted it to MIDEX, NASA proposal opportunities. And this is some kind of telescope like 1.5 meter. And we have 10 to the 9 contrast demonstrated in a laboratory at JPL for some years now in 10 and 20% bandwidths at 3 lambda over deseparation from the star. So we know how to make a camera that does this. And so we, several groups have gotten interested in this as a whole bunch. I could tell you about it over coffee. They've all proposed different options for the coronagraph design. And if you put it on a 1.5 meter free-flying telescope, you could do debris disk imaging down to sort of the 10 ZOTY level instead of the 1,000 ZOTY level where we're stuck right now. And you could also get spectra of some RV planets in the optical. So we've been trying to get this to happen. It hasn't been happening. We'll propose it whenever NASA gives another exoplanet probe opportunity, but that could be who knows how long from now. So what can we do in the near term before this? And that is that ground AO imaging is going to make some progress, but it has only detected high surface brightness disks up to this point, ones that are edge-on or really narrow rings. So it's even up to this point, the ground has been short by a factor of 10 relative to Hubble. So what we've been working on now, and Wes is probably on a telecon for it right this moment, is the idea of putting this kind of coronagraph that we have from the lab at JPL on a stratospheric balloon. So if you do that, then it floats above all the turbulence that makes the seeing problem for ground-based AO. And we think with debris disks, you wouldn't need to get to the 10 to the 9 contrast for planets. That's harder. There's a whole range of contrasts that we expect, but up to 10 to the 7 for nearby debris disks that Spitzer has found. And then debris disks also have the advantage of being larger, so you don't have to look as close into the star. It doesn't stress your spatial resolution and your inner working angle for the coronagraph as much. So we're trying to finish next week, I think, our proposal for a stratospheric balloon development project that would try to fly a coronagraph and get some images of debris disks that, you know, Hubble and ground AO can't do. Right, well, we're just hatched the idea since that KISS workshop.
Would Sophia not be high enough?
Well, the turbulence everywhere with Sophia. If they would actually open the door with a telescope and show us what they're seeing, is they expect the seeing to be, you know, arc second size seeing. There's going to be vibration issues for coronagraphs. And I think nobody thinks Sophia is going to be good for high contrast stuff.
So the balloon gets you how much higher than Sophia?
Oh, the balloon is 100,000 feet. So it's not so much the lack of atmospheric absorbing, because we're going to be operating in the visible. It's the fact that you get above all the turbulence that a ground telescope is the biggest challenge for ground AO and high contrast stuff.
Why are you still looking at
long duration as well?
Okay, sir.
Long duration as well.
Well, the duration of balloons is a problem. NASA wants to develop long duration balloons. They haven't actually gotten one flying yet. They have a development project for it.
More than a few hours.
Oh yeah, here.
Well, existing balloons go for like a week.
Exactly. Yeah. With one night, we could look at least a couple sources if our coronagraph performance can be made happy there. We have to make sure we don't make too much seeing from our own, you know, heat dissipation on the instrument is the major challenge. Hasn't been much thought about that.
There's a lot of ballooning down
in
Antarctica.
I mean, if you want to be up, like, what is it? You have to be like 10 meters above the ground layer in order to have good seeing in Antarctica. Is that right? Something like that? Telescope on a platform. You don't want to be like right at the ground level, but if you get up above the ground.
There is some. I was thinking about the balloons. Because it's long duration.
Oh, yeah.
It's circumpolar.
How high do those long wavelength? They may require actually being in some part of the atmospheric motion in order to get a nice circular motions around the bulb. What would the trajectory be if you let a bubble or the jet streams and start producing? You might just drift off the sun.
Well, the major problem with Antarctica is that if it's, you have to do this at night, okay, and the night is very long, and the power system that you provide in a long-duration balloon just isn't going to last very long. So 1 week of operations at regular latitudes will probably tell us a lot about whether we can get the system to work and get initial science.
But 1 week of measurement of steering one particular object or one class of objects or one field, I think, would be very good.
Yeah, I think we aim to do that right now, not in Antarctica, but how much we can do definitely depends on what the duration is that can be achieved. And right now we're trying to squeeze in under a budget cap and propose for something that would just have a couple flights and hope to prove that it works. And
there's lots of ballooning done in Antarctica. Right. They're trying to get above the water. There's CMB measurements. There's lots of those. Right. So there was some virtue, and there's a history and tradition for doing this now.
I think if we get this to work at a mid-latitude site, we would definitely be looking to do it in Antarctica.
ISF is frequently looking for justifications for maintaining a polar presence.
Okay, well, West has been through all the balloon wars before, doing atmospheric stuff, and so that's why he's the head honcho of this, and I think he's on the phone right now talking about it.
You mentioned multiple flights, so your camera survives the landing?
Well, the camera is not the problem as much as the telescope. You want to fly a 1 meter telescope. So just imagine what we saw at Las Cumbres, the bigger one, somehow.
The answer is sometimes.
Sometimes,
in,
yeah.
In existing telescopes that are on balloons, the answer is sometimes.
It's a risk, yeah. But right now we're totally stuck for flight opportunities. The space mission version of this, we just don't know when or how it's going to happen. So we've got to pursue all the alternatives.
I mentioned this because it's going to be much, much cheaper than any space mission.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's 10 times worse.
Yep.
Don't fly over my house.
So how long you have power for on this thing is an issue, what we're saying?
Well, the idea is to just plan for one night's flight to get everything tested to work right now. For multiple nights, what we could do is put solar panels on the side so it could recharge its batteries during the day and then go for multiple nights.
What I was wondering is, if you have something at 100,000 feet, is there any way you can like beam something up to it, like a laser, microwave, whatever?
It sounds like a way to blow the balloon, yeah.
That's right, yeah, your aim has to be real good.
So for more details on this specifically, I wish Wes was here. But Wes could tell you lots about the balloon details at Coffee because he's heading up the proposal, and he's not here because he's working on getting it done. And I've got something I have to do for him on the proposal today. So we're submitting the final version a week from today.
So why is the contrast ratio lower in the balloon or higher as you have in the balloon and the space-based telescope?
Oh, I meant to think of this as worse. So the space-based telescope, we would shoot for 1 billion to 1, and here we would shoot for only 100 million to 1.
That's what I'm asking.
Oh.
What's your thought?
Oh, well, the lab test would say we could go ahead and do that right now. I guess we're being pessimistic about how well the pointing is going to do on the balloon. A balloon has not pointed to arc-second accuracies in the past. So if the star is wandering off the occulting spot of the coronagraph, then it degrades the overall contrast. So there's that issue, and then we're also not sure how, our lab test is in a vacuum tank. Okay, so it simulates space conditions, but there's going to be some residual seeing at balloon altitude. So we don't think it's a good idea to promise this kind of performance level. And you don't need it to get to debris disk, because the unimaged debris disks are predicted to have contrasts starting at 10 to the minus 7, and if you can get to 10 to the minus 8, you're going to get dozens of them. Okay. And that's all I had about disks, planets, and balloons.
Any other comments?
Could you detect formal halt with that balloon?
It shouldn't work either because, again, our control radius for the DM of the coronagraph will clear out a dark hole that's 3 arcseconds radius. There's an advantage to be a small telescope because the number of Landover D you clear out depends on how big the formable mirror is. So if you have a small telescope, you actually clear out to a wider area, but it's still only 3 arcseconds. So I would not expect. Also, this won't have a photon sensitivity to detect formal halt B, I don't think.
In India, they have very good facilities also for ballooning in Hyderabad, and I understand that a lot cheaper than the balloons you can fly here because of the workmanship is much cheaper. Mm-hmm. And I do very good things.
That's something to tell Wes at coffee.
And, no. and they recover their behavior at those coaches, which they lost quite often. And as far as I've seen, they always recover the same, so it's not destroyed.
Yeah, and how big is that telescope, do you know?
I think it's 1 meter.
Still? Okay.
It's a Tata Institute in Bombay, he does this thing, but okay. The station isn't
there. I'll ask Wes about it, and if you see him, ask him too. So I wish he was here to take your interest in this.
And you're not using PIA in the vacuum test?
Well, that's being vacuum tested at JPL right now, but it's 2 orders of magnitude short of the LEO coronagraph contrast. It just can't get there right now, and there's a bunch of gnashing of teeth as to exactly what the reason is for that. But,
okay, so it's not fulfilling its promise yet.
Not yet. This is a coronagraph concept that works right in the computer and is intending to give you very high throughput at small inner working angles. So because the balloon wouldn't be pushing to a small inner working angle, we wouldn't need this.
That's a 3 lambda per meter. You're supposed to be able to get about a half lambda per meter, 1 lambda per meter. That was PIA.
What was PIA?
It stands for phase-induced amplitude anthetization. And the basic idea is that you try to reshape the distribution of light across the pupil of the telescope so that you take light away from the edges. Okay, and so then when you encounter stops and so forth, you don't have much light at the edges, and it reduces the diffraction greatly. While they can make something work at 1 arcsecond, one lambda over d and so forth in terms of having throughput there, the thing that kills you trying to look in close is that the stability of the telescope, because the telescope drifts in focus or if it drifts in secondary alignment in other ways, then it causes light to appear in the 2 lambda over d, 3 lambda over d kind of region. So no one has yet demonstrated that you would have a telescope stable enough to take advantage of the claimed ability of PIAA to work at 1 lambda over d. So Olivier consistently avoids this aspect when he discusses it.
Attention. He's trying to build this on Subaru.
Well, maybe we should go into a private conversation now about this. But,
okay,
the main, you can work at 2 lambda over d or 1 lambda over d with other coronagraphs in PIAA. The only thing that PIA does is it lets you have higher throughput,
right.
Maximizes the throughput at if you're working the coronagraph at 1 lambda over d. The issue for Subaru high contrast imaging is not throughput. It's suppressing the strength of the halo and how well the AO system does. So I don't see benefit of using a PIA system on the ground when you're limited by speckle contrast. If you were limited by throughput, I would see the advantage. And it's in the TPF situation, throughput is the whole issue. Because the Earths are 31st magnitude objects, you want to take spectra of them, so you don't want to lose a factor of 2 in throughput. So you want to consider it there. But on the ground, it's the speckle contrast that's limiting you, so I view it just as a technology demo to try to do it on Subaru. It's not going to enable some science that you wouldn't get another way. Yeah.
Let's thank Carl once again for a great presentation.